Hello and welcome to We Cut Heads, a Spike Lee podcast. I'm your host Spencer, and with me is he's a strange, almost middle-aged man. He lives alone in a mansion, not mansion, but a nice house on Martha's Vineyard.
Yeah, this guy was living my best life, I have to say. I mean, you know, just a place that nobody ever comes to, and I don't have to interact with anybody. Although I like trees, there's no trees on Martha's Vineyard. Hey, it's me, Joel.
Well, you had a tree.
I mean, he's got a certain kind. He's got, you know, beach associated trees. I like a real wood.
Oh, like a weeping willow.
Or and something. You can take that exactly how you.
Okay. Yeah, this episode is the first part of the Gontra and Hess pairing, which we're doing Spike's remake, Just People Are Jesus from 2014. Instead of doing the Oscar from this year, which was Birdman, I think, we're going to do instead the original Gontra and Hess, because that's one of my favorite movies, and I want an excuse to watch it again and talk about it. So for the Spike Lee version, we have Marcus Penn coming on again.
Hello.
Hey.
How's it going? Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. So, you're the first person I asked about coming on to the Spike Lee season, and immediately you said, "To Sweet Blood Jesus."
Yeah, I think it needs some defenders. I like this movie. I think it got a, and we'll get into it. Why I think it was judged and got a bad rep before it even like really came out. And yeah, just visually, I really like it. Thematically, I like it, you know, and as I just said a few seconds ago, I think this movie, it needs more defenders. I think people need to really kind of give this movie a second chance or even a first chance, because I know people who haven't even given it a first chance.
Huh. Yeah, I think when this first came out, at the time, I listened to a movie podcast that I forgot the name of, but I have brought up before, because one of the hosts hates every single Clint Eastwood movie. And
Every what movie?
Clint Eastwood movie.
Oh.
Yeah, he hates how Clint uses shadow and light, and I brought it up on Million Dollar Baby and the other one we did, because Clint sure loves to play with shadow and light. It's kind of ridiculous, and I can't unsee it. But,
He was born during the era of silent films, right? I mean,
he's like 90 or some shit now. Mm-hmm. But, but the one host, he hated Clint. Also, kind of hated every Spike movie, so the first impression I had of this was it's bad, and like no one on that podcast understood it, so I kind of avoided it for a while.
Well, Wait, hold on. Spencer, what is this dipshit actually like?
Jeez.
That's right, I'm fucking calling him out.
I remember his name, but I won't say his name on the air. Because he's trying to be a screenwriter and shit, so.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. Yeah, so, like, my first impression of this was, like, this weird vampire movie that I probably shouldn't watch, but once I saw Gontra and Hess and I learned about this, it's kind of like, well, eventually I will watch it. But so Joel, did you have any history with this? Like, did you know of this beforehand?
Who are you talking to, me?
Yeah.
Oh, I just heard it wasn't good. I heard it was, you know,
exactly.
A series of Spike Lee movies that came out within a year of each other that seemed to be not of this caliber people were expecting. So, I mean, I haven't seen most Spike Lee movies. So
and that's kind of another problem, too.
Yeah, but I have to tell you, I haven't seen Gontra and Hess, so I don't have a comparison. And I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed Sweet Blood of Jesus.
Huh. I'm in the same camp. I like this movie. I don't think it fully works, but just like it's definitely more interesting than like bad, the way it kind of its reputation makes it seem like. And I got to give a quick warning. My dog is here, near me, because my girlfriend is in Spain visiting her sister right now. So
your dog hates vampires, is that why?
No, our neighbors, she likes to bark at the dog upstairs from here.
I see.
So she might freak out and go on a barking spree at some point.
Well, that was a good podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, so... Yeah, Freya did watch some of it with me. She fell asleep and didn't seem to care very much. But that's her reaction to every movie.
Right.
Unless there's a dog on screen, then she gets interested.
So how do you want to tackle this? Like, do you want to talk about the problems or why people seem to dislike it so much? Or do you want to talk about the good things first?
I think going with, I guess the problems first would be better, so to end on a positive note.
Yeah, well, also, yeah, I mean, it's not my, I don't want to assert myself too much, but I think I think that's the best way to start, because this movie had problems before it even really came out, and it just set a really bad tone. Like, it was kind of clouded with negativity. I don't know if people know this was his, like, crowdfunded movie. Does anyone remember, like, how he went about, like, crowdfunding for this and, like, his campaigning to get money for this movie?
No. I remember hearing it was crowdfunded, but that is the extent of it.
Yeah, even down to the soundtrack, he actually, the soundtrack, he took, like, open submissions from, like, emerging bands and stuff for the soundtrack, not for the score, but for the soundtrack. But, so, I don't even know if it's up still, but he did, like, a live stream kind of, like, fundraiser video. And when he was explaining what he was trying to raise money for, he was super vague. He was like, I need $1.4 million to make this movie. I'm thinking of doing some kind of horror movie, maybe a vampire movie. I don't know. I can't quote him word for word, but that's what he was saying on the video. So right away, you know, folks, well, why am I going to give you money if, like, you don't even know what you're going to make fully? It was, you know... So there was that, and this was also during that period where it was, like, you know, James Franco and Zach Braff and other, like, I don't like to be in people's pockets, but, like, well-off people were crowdfunding for budgets for movies, and that's fine, except a lot of times when they do that, the whole backstory is, like, this is a really personal thing for me, I'm very passionate about it, I don't want the studios, and it's kind of like... Well, if you're passionate about it, like, use your millions of dollars. Or if not, like, you have resources. Like, everyone who I listed, some of their best friends are millionaires also. So it's like, I don't know why you need, like, my 50 bucks or anything. So Spike Lee caught a lot of flack. So before the movie even began production, it was just, like I said, it was clouded with, like, you know, weirdness. And then this was also, The Sweet Blood of Jesus is sandwiched between... probably Spike Lee's worst era. I mean, you had Red Hook, Summer, and Old Boy back to back, and then after The Sweet Blood of Jesus, you had Chirac.
No.
So it was just like a bunch of movies, and it wasn't like even prior to Red Hook, Summer, he was like the man. You know what I'm saying? You know, it was like She Hate Me, Inside Man was fine, Miracle at St. Anna, nobody really remembers that, and like Passing Strange was kind of like not a lot of people saw that. So he was just in a weird spot already to begin with. And then, so, like, a string of, like, not good movies, I think a lot of people were just like, eh, it's probably not that good. And then people forgot about it, and then, like, it had, like, one press screening, and, like, a couple of critics saw it, and, like, only one or two people wrote about it, and it got, like, two net negative reviews before anybody saw it. So, like I said, it was just, like, one bad thing after another before it even rolled out or hit theaters. So I'm not sure if you or anybody listening remembers that, because I remember because around that time, that's when word got out that it was like, oh, he's remaking another movie, because he remade Old Boy just before. It's like he's remaking Ganja and Hess.
Wasn't Old Boy a good for hire job? He wasn't like a Spike Lee.
Well, you know what though, I think if that movie ended up being good or like critically acclaimed, I don't think he would have said that, because you know, it's not like. that movie did, you know, that movie starred some of his regulars. You know, it had some of, he also, and did you see it?
Old Boy, yes. And,
He even inserted, like, racial, you know, themes into it. So it wasn't that for hire, you know what I'm saying? It was also, I remember the big hype about that movie was this was, like, the first collaboration between him and Samuel Jackson after a long time. Because, you know, they didn't get along for a while and threw shots at each other and blah, blah, blah. So I don't know. I mean, I'm sure he doesn't hold Old Boy up, you know, on the same pedestal as he does, like, Do the Right Thing. But I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that the movie wasn't good. They changed the twist ending a little bit, which it's like, what's the point of doing that? If you're going to remake Old Boy, why do that?
Yeah.
So, so I think by the time it came around to Sweet Blood Jesus, everybody was just kind of, I don't want to say they were done with him, but they were just like, I don't know. I don't know. So, and then I was lucky enough, before it came out, I was lucky enough to get, a screener of it, like the distributor. I somehow got in contact with them, blah, blah, blah. And then this website that I used to write for, Cutprint Film, I wrote a nice review of it, and it ended up on their site. It ended up getting a decent bit of traction because it was like, I feel like it was maybe one of the first, like, good reviews of it. And my whole tone of the movie was, I'm not going to go, you know, overboard and be like, oh, this is one of the best of the year. But my whole... the whole crux of my review was, everybody relax, it's actually pretty good, like, just relax, it's actually good. Like, just because it's not a masterpiece doesn't mean that it's bad. Like, there's middle ground, and this movie is actually pretty good. You know, I think back in college, when Soderbergh remade Solaris, I didn't like it at first, and then I was like, well, wait a minute, hold on. Why don't I like it? Is it just because he remade a classic? And then I started watching it a lot, you know, in my early 20s, and I realized I like Solaris a lot. And from that moment on, it made me not have that knee-jerk reaction of whenever someone's remaking, like, a classic or a cult classic to immediately hate it. Hmm. Like, that Soderbergh Solaris got me to, you know, go, oh, someone's remaking this movie? That's actually kind of ballsy. Like, what how are they going to put their own twist on it? And I had already seen Ganja and Hess a bunch of times, so I was more fascinated and intrigued than like, oh, he's remaking a classic, blah, blah, blah. I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. I wonder what he's, you know, what he's going to come with. So,
yeah. Going off of the remake note, Black Christmas is getting remade again with a woman director this time, so maybe it'll be better than the other one.
It's about time.
Yes.
Oh, I gotta say, you know, I
Sophie Takal.
I'm a little intrigued. Yeah, Sophie Takal. She's a good filmmaker.
Yeah, she did. She Green, this indie movie from 5 years ago or so, with Mary Green. Called Green. She's in something on the roof in July. What's it called?
Yeah, well, her and her. I'm not sure if they're married. I think they are, but. Lawrence Michael Levine, he's also a filmmaker and a producer. They work pretty exclusively together. Because Sophia Takal is also an actress. But she made this movie called, have you seen Always Shine?
I've heard of it, but that's one of the ones I haven't seen.
Yeah, that was a movie she made. That was her last feature. It was from a couple years ago. And it's with Mackenzie Davis, who she's starting to blow up. Yeah, like, Always Shine, it's like a psychological thriller, somewhat horror. It's kind of like her, I mean, everyone who's written about this movie has said it, but rightfully so. It's like her persona, her Robert Altman images, her Mulholland Drive. It's all in that same vein of movie.
Oh, okay. That's called...
It's really, really good, though. Sounds good. I think.
Gabby on the Roof in July. That's what I'm trying to think of.
Right. Yeah, I think Michael Lawrence Levine directed that, her husband.
Yeah, and VHS, she has a segment in that. She has acting and directing, but I overall like her stuff a whole lot. But, back to The Sweet Blood Jesus. I think, I don't mind big tone shifts, when they're done well, or, in service of, the themes or the plot. I saw Old Boy, the original Old Boy, when I was 15, when it first hit VOD, because somehow I heard of it, and, the big tone shifts in it kind of, at that, like that scene in a big chunk of that young kind of, I like geared me to like, okay, movies can have like a huge shift and it's okay. And so like, right. was like that, so it kind of helped with like the Spike, certain Spike movies, like the tone can be all over the place. And like with this, mm-hmm. it jumps from this, like it's all about class mainly and other things, but like it jumps from this romance to him dealing with trying to fit in with like upper class, and it jumps genres and like a color palette, and it's this kind of this weird mishmash, which I understand if someone sees it and be like and thinks it's poorly done, but I think it's clearly on purpose because it's just dealing with a whole bunch of stuff.
I'm not really sure what you mean by the tone shifts. Like the only things that kind of felt like out of place to me were the things that were very evidently Spike Lee, like director signatures.
Mm-hmm. Like his sister showing up as a nurse.
No, that was fine. I mean, what was wrong with that?
No,
she's an actress.
That is true.
I guess you were distracted by it. Like, what the hell?
No, it's like his comedy like doesn't work sometimes.
Sometimes it doesn't work. Yeah.
Yeah, like
no, it doesn't work. It doesn't work a lot.
in this movie, I can't think of. I mean, I guess we're supposed to find the first prostitute he picks up at that club. We're supposed to find that whole part funny, but yeah, you know, I mean, it devolves into such a way. Like, the overall tone of this movie is strange.
And yeah,
I don't think
you're absolutely right, but and that's kind of why I like it. But it's also but the thing what's a little off to me, and I say off in a good way, is like, you know, Spencer touched on it, you know, just like a minute or two ago. It's like the color palette. It's just like, and I guess a lot of it has to do with it. It's shot digitally. Like it doesn't look like a movie, but it also doesn't look cheap. So it's hard to kind of put your finger on, like, what's going on here. It's like a feature film, but it looks like you know, a Netflix or like a Hulu series or something. But the colors also pop. It's like, I immediately think of red, like every shade of red when I think of The Sweet Blood of Jesus. And, you know, of course, I mean, the movie's about blood, so it's kind of, it's very on the nose, but, even if it doesn't look like a movie, like shot on film, it still looks really, really beautiful, though, you know?
Yeah, like it continues like the dreamy, like to me it has like a dreamy look to it, kind of like how Contra Cast feels very dreamy, and it's Spike's version of trying to like create a weird dreamy atmosphere, which I haven't seen all his movies, but the one that I have seen, I won't really say that about any of his other movies, like Bamboozled. Definitely is not a beautiful movie, except for the minstrelsy segments, and the rest is kind of ugly on purpose, and then, like, Do the Right Thing is, like, hazy and hot-looking, but it's not necessarily dreamy, and this one has has that strange atmosphere to it.
Another thing that this has that none of the other movies we've at least covered for the podcast have is this, like, severe sense of loneliness. Like, every other one of his movies are packed with so many people, and not just famous people, but, you know, the regular crowd, that, you know, the busy New York thing. And this movie has so much of the solitude going on, even before the movie shifts to a vampire movie from the beginning, that it's kind of unnerving. Like, that part was like, well, this is different for him. Like, how often has he ever just been like, this isn't about, like, everybody affecting the characters I've chosen to put on screen, but it really is kind of a once we get two-character study piece going on. You know, at first it's all about Dr. Green there, but it just felt weird that there weren't a ton of other people coming in and out of their existence. Even that club scene is just so inconsequential when it comes to the story of the movie. It's like it didn't even really affect what was going on. And there's that part where he goes to get his checked out and make sure he doesn't have HIV, where he is literally sitting arm to arm next to people, but he might as well be alone in that room.
Yeah, isn't he the only one wearing all black and everyone else is wearing lighter colors?
Yeah, I thought it was funny that, like, that was his idea of kind of dressing to blend in, but when you look at his clothes, everything's brand new, and it, like, kind of, like, it does a slow scan down what he's wearing. Like, even his shoes are brand new. It's like, this guy isn't one of the hoi polloi here.
Yeah, it's and he's wearing a New York Knicks hat tying into the intro,
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, the intro, which I was trying to figure out and decipher what it was, and at Slant, the review, they gave it like 3.5 out of 4 stars. But like who did Slant?
Wow.
Yeah, and
oh, I didn't know that.
They also gave Red Hook Summer 3 stars out of 4, which...
Jesus.
Yeah, that's... I don't get that.
3 stars too many.
I'd go 2 stars too many. But,
Tom kept... Hey, fair enough.
But,
real quick, I want to go back to, like, the scene of him where he picks up that woman. I think that is... I think, you know, any kind of, like, vampire, cannibal, like, I'm changing into something... kind of movie needs those kind of scenes, because that's when you see, like, oh, okay, this is, he's turned. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think that scene is kind of important, because it's no different than, like, you know, American Werewolf in London. He gets attacked by this werewolf, and then he's recovered, and then, like, we have the sympathy for him, but then, like, oh, he gets the urge, you know, to kill.
The Fly.
What else? Like, you know, Trouble Every Day, The Fly, exactly. Yeah. The Fly is another, or Trouble Every Day, where it's just, like, oh, this guy is sick and blah, blah, blah. Vincent Gallo's sick. And then finally, it turns out, you know, this whole time he's been preying on this woman. And then that's when he turns. It's kind of like, I think those kind of scenes are important to movies like this. So, but that's just me.
Yeah, let's go back to that. Vincent Gallo is sick. Okay, anyways. no. And but, yeah, I think it's interesting, though, that he's not, like in a typical vampire movie, the vampire becomes the... you know, the seducer, the suave person, mm-hmm. but that is not the case with here. Like, he's picking up women that, you know, expect him to pay. So you know, the way they do the vampire powers is like, well, he doesn't really have power. He's just really needs blood to survive kind of thing. I thought was a pretty good take on it.
Yeah. But going back to the dancing, like the Slant review brought up that it's a referencing Do the Right Thing, where Do the Right Thing is Rosie Perez dancing aggressively to a Public Enemy, and it's like
sure.
Okay.
Sorry. Just like, yeah, he did, yeah, okay. Well, he does have dancing in both of those.
Yeah, but he points out like that's making a statement about like this movie will be aggressive and like in your face, and it will like be powerful, because like her dancing is very like bold and powerful, and dancing in this is they equate it to like it's a self-reflection of like Spike is no longer like the guy who like lives in Brooklyn. He's kind of like an upper middle, he's not like an upper class guy. He's like, you know, he is like Dr. Green to an extent, where like he's, you know, the kind of thing is that like it's probably getting to, like, his feelings, his personal feelings on, like, being upper class or, like, being in upper class.
Well, I like that interpretation. So
yeah.
apologize for my snarkiness.
No, it's fine. But, like, because I bring up the dancing in here is very graceful. And, like, the guy's wearing all New York Knicks things and some of it. And, like, it opens with, like, the New York Knicks on a basketball court. So like I think they are probably along the right thought line with like it's the Spike kind of self-reflecting, because like why else would it be so much New York Knicks stuff, you know, like in the opening?
Sure. Yeah.
But do you have any thoughts on that, Marcus, on like the dancing and in the opening or not?
Wait, the event. I'm sorry. Say that again.
On like the dancing and the opening, like what's supposed to like represent and all that. Because like I'm still.
I just kind of. I mean, it's. I immediately thought of a callback to like Do the Right Thing. Also sprinkled in with a little bit of a 25th hour, like when, you know, the movie starts, he's kind of, you know, Edward Norton sitting on the boardwalk, and then you see the druggie, who we come to find out at the end of the movie that that druggie guy was like some rich Wall Street guy. I didn't really look too much deep into that until other than it's just kind of like an artsy kind of opening to a movie. I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe I missed something on that one. I'm not sure.
No.
Yeah.
Or maybe the Slant review is full of shit with that. Who knows? But, all right. So, Joel, what questions do you have, like, of weirdness? Because you haven't seen Godren Hess, so I'm not sure some stuff will not make sense.
Well, no, my general questions were, like, what was the major issue with it? I think I get it, because it's not, this didn't seem like in Spike Lee's other movies that we've seen, like, there were so many moments of just music with, you know, people walking or sitting there. It felt way more of, you know, to use a stupid term, it felt like an arty movie to me, you know? I felt like I was watching things that would have been made on a lower budget from, like, the late 60s or early 70s. And that feels very unusual for what he's known for. So I just don't know, like, where the huge... I don't know where the big disconnect is, because, like we were talking about before, I feel like this is a movie where people are like, oh, God, it was terrible. And I don't get that. There are things I don't like about the movie, mm-hmm. especially, but those... that kind of winds back to the problems that I have with Spike Lee stuff going mm-hmm. on. Like, is... I was really enjoying how Ganja was... Mm-hmm. As a character, and then he was like, but lesbians, and hey, man, yeah. Come on.
Yeah, come on. It's interesting Marcus
sure.
also picked the other lesbian movie, too.
Oh, yeah.
Are you trying to say something?
Yeah, I mean, you kind of just said it. I think there's definitely some, like, self-indulgent kind of stuff in the Sweet Blood of Jesus. There definitely is. But, yeah, you know, I don't want to repeat myself too much, but I think all the factors that I brought up earlier, combined with the look of the film, I do think, wasn't the only, but we were starting to get into, like, this and Red Hook Summer. They both kind of look like, these are like his first two movies that didn't really look like, I'm, you know, using air quotes, movies. They didn't look like anything else he had done. And I think, like you had said, Spencer, I think, you know, at a quick glance, it kind of looks cheap, but it really doesn't if you go back and look at it. Yeah. So,
yeah, like the color.
Yeah, you know. Oh, I'm sorry.
I mentioned the color palette is kind of varied, and it's makes these bold changes in, like, the color and like the music, yeah. And just, like, there's a lot of big shifts, just like with the tone and, like, the color and the appearance. So, like, sure. That certainly throw some people off.
Sure. No, absolutely. I think it did. And I can't stress enough. I think this is a movie that almost gets, like, forgotten about. I feel like people sometimes almost, like, jump from Old Boy to Chirac. You know, which, you know, but both of those movies are awful. Chirac more than Old Boy, but still.
Hmm.
Damn, I lost my train of thought. I was trying to say, Joel, you were saying, like, why people just kind of hate on it. I think part of it is, I had said that it was kind of self-indulgent, and I think that's part of it. Like, I think on a personal level, the older I get, I don't know about you guys, like, I like messier movies,
mm-hmm.
movies that I can't just completely, like, gush about, and movies that I just completely hate. Like, I almost have not much to say about either. Like, these are movies where it's just like, oh, there's a lot of stuff here, and there's also stuff I didn't like, but you could talk about it respectfully. Like, you could just kind of go on and on and on about movies like that, where it's like, if a movie is great, I'm just kind of like, yeah, it was great. Here's why, and I'm done. Or like, when a movie is terrible, with a few exceptions, it's like, oh, that was bad. I don't have anything to say. But this is like, I wish more people thought that way. I think when a movie is just kind of like weird and odd and off, mm-hmm. people are at a loss for words. But if anything, I think people should go off of that and go off like, what's the first thing you're thinking of? Just start talking. And next thing you know, like you'll make these revelations and you'll have all these things. You know, you'll come up with everything. Like this is totally. I never saw this movie in the theater. Like I said, I got it like in a digital screener of it. I wish I had seen this in the theater with people who'd like want to talk about it as soon as it was over. So.
Yeah, I don't. The more unusual a movie is, the more I like it. Like even if something is. Comes out to be bad. Like if it's something I haven't really experienced before, I'm usually very much into it. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to be like, oh man, that was a great movie. Everybody needs to watch it. You know, sometimes I was experiencing Liquid Sky for the first time, and I'm like, that is a weird ass movie, and I was enjoying the fact that I hadn't really experienced anything. I'm not going to tell anybody to watch that. But this one had a bunch of things where I was like, huh, this is really, yeah, he's going in directions I just didn't expect. So that's the thing, yeah, for me, good stuff.
Yeah, I mean, like, some, like, I guess some quote-unquote problems would be, like, it's definitely a little sleazier and more violent than Conjuring Hess.
Mm.
And, like, there's more of a sexualizing the women here. When Godwin has Dwayne Jones is definitely far more sexualized than Marlene Clark, and because Bill Gunn, I think he was bi or gay, mm-hmm. but like you know, it definitely did emphasize like the sexuality of Dwayne Jones far more than the Marlene Clark, and with this one, like Stephen Tyrone Williams. He's not quite as like traditionally masculine as Dwayne Jones, but
no, he's not.
No, but like I do like the change, and like he's still it's like the change of like instead of just repeating everything, it's like, hey, what if instead of someone who's very like a take charge type of man, someone who's a little more I guess softer and quieter instead of
he definitely is yeah he speak yeah he's very yeah he's very quieter and softer. Yeah, but and going back to the whole like the way women are shown in this movie, the kind of like lipstick lesbianism, it's like, I mean, if you look at a lot of Spike Lee's movies, it's kind of like in his track record, like even down to like when Spike Lee is in his own movies, it's like look who his you know leading like his hit like who he's casted with, you know, like in in Jungle Fever, it's like, you know, former supermodel model Veronica Webb, you know, is his wife. He like Rosie Perez is his woman in Do the Right Thing. It's like and then and even in stuff like, you know, that he's not in, like we already talked about She Hate Me, or when you look at a movie like Jesus, He Got Game,
mm-hmm.
or Son of Sam, there's all, it's like he kind of quietly has a history of just like hot chicks, like that's definitely his thing. You don't realize it right away, but when you look at like half of his movies, it's just like, oh, he likes to at times unnecessarily sexualize women.
Yeah,
when it's not necessary.
Watching them.
right.
And honestly, it's kind of an unfair thing to hold against this movie in particular, except for how much sexuality was going on in those scenes. Because when it comes to vampire fiction, every female vampire is automatically assumed to be lesbian for some reason, probably because it's mostly written by guys.
They're the tradition of it, like with the Carmilla story from like that predates Dracula. I'm not sure.
You know who wrote that? A dude.
Okay, fine.
I'm just kidding.
I'm not sure who wrote it. And there's like the whole string of lesbian vampire movies in the 70s with like what the fuck was his name? Spaniard. Jess Franco and Jean Roland, which I like.
Right.
Yeah, I like.
You mean like Vampiros Lesbos or something?
Yeah, that's a great movie.
I mean, why would you assume there were lesbians in that movie? That's weird.
Yeah, but like, you know, there's a whole tradition of it, and like, you know, here I guess he has an excuse of like, of course she's you know, goes both ways. She's a vampire, but like with She Hate Me, there's kind of no excuse where it's like, you know, that's just an immature, a poorly written script.
Yeah, go back, listen to our She Hate Me episode. Really good.
Yeah.
For those of you listening.
And, okay, so, like, there are some moments that stuck out that, I have no clue what it's referencing at the party, at his house with all, like, the rich white people. I think it's all rich white people. I don't think you see anyone of color besides Rami Malek. Oscar winner Rami Malek.
Yep.
Right. Award. Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah. So if you were upset about that, you know, maybe you should watch this movie.
I like him in this.
I know, but
yeah, he has a great scene.
Yeah. And
what's that?
I'm saying, if you're upset about his Oscar win, you want to see something violent to happen to him. Maybe you'll watch this movie. I don't know.
Or if Old Boy, because he's also in that and dies.
Yeah.
Well, I haven't seen that yet.
Oh. I expect it's another movie. I hope Rami shows up in that one again. But there's the cut of like the white dude saying "Bucky dead, Bucky dead." Like I'm not sure what that is. I'm not sure if that was like a hip hop reference or like a sports thing.
Wait, what's that? What's that?
Like the two... he's talking to. There were those white guys that were just like repeating the same things over and over
again.
They're
saying "Bucky dead, Bucky dead," and another. So, like I said, "Bucky fucking dead, Bucky fucking dead."
I assumed it was.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I couldn't figure out what that was.
Yeah, I don't. I'm not sure what that is either.
Yeah,
because when they're like driving away, he says something too. That was definitely a sports reference.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's some like real on the nose stuff, like when Hightower in this one, not Mita, is in a tree. I think Dr. Hess says like, "God didn't buy this 40 acres, I did," which is a real like, if you know Spike, it's like, oh, I get what that's a reference to. But I don't know, like. I guess we're going to get to like, the stuff I like overall. Cause, I mean, there are just other weird moments that I'm still not sure what, like, why I was there. But, I like that Thomas Jefferson Bird is in this as the same character from Retroc Summer. So it's kind of like a good sequel to that. And this anytime he's in a Spike movie, I immediately like it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Even though he's not given much to do. He's in the Sam Wayman role from Godger and Hess, but it's still nice to see like this him show up at all. Although
I like I was saying, I really like the strange tone of it because we had a lot of things were just most of these conversations coming from Hess in the movie is he's this monotone kind of nerd who it seems like even before he gets turned over that he's already an alien amongst these people. It kept making me think of Space is the Place and like weird conversations that were going on in there, you know. Hmm. And then of course we'd had like a long song sequence and stuff like that, and like, hey, what's going on here? I just really dug the way it was paced out, and I don't know, there were some, yeah, I don't know. There's just something special about it. I wish I could put my finger on it. I just barely finished the movie before we started recording, though, so I think I'll be thinking about it for a while.
I mean, like the color red shows up everywhere And like,
yeah,
I like the, I forgot what it is in the beginning, but like you see some color red stuff, and that's like foreshadowing the blood slash foreshadowing when Ganja shows up, because she's wearing like a red outfit with a red hat and a red luggage.
Yep.
And she says she's coming from Amsterdam, which I think is an exact line from Ganja and Hess. And I also think that's a reference to the monologue that George Mita does in it, where he has that awful story about he's on a set of a movie and it gets real awkward because he thinks he's funny, but he isn't. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about. Joel, you're going to see what I'm talking about in a day or two.
Sure. Yeah.
But like, but there are some, like, I mean, structurally, it follows Gardner Hess pretty closely. Like, down to, like, getting a hooker and killing her for her blood, and then killing a hooker who had a baby. Although here, it's much more graphic. Like, with the stuff of the baby, because if you see, because in Gardner Hess, I don't think you see him, like, really talking to the woman beforehand. You would see, like, him going to her house, and then, like, cut, and it's like she's dead, and the baby's crying.
Yeah.
And here, like, he lingers on, like, talking to the baby, and then a camera moves over, and it's like, oh, he cut her up. Which totally is, kind of falls into Spike's emotional manipulation, like in Malcolm X with, Sean Carl Esposito at the end with like the dolly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That reminds me of the movie Under the Skin, which also has a harrowing scene involving a very young child that where, you know, the character does something where it's like that person can't be a human. And, you know, this was the biggest display that like this guy is not human anymore. Like he is completely separated when he just leaves that baby there. Like, even like, oh, it was nice to meet you. Yeah. Bye.
That's a good point. Oh, yeah, it's a good comparison.
Yeah. I mean, like from the beginning, he's clearly very withdrawn and seems uncomfortable just being, just, like, existing among other humans.
Yeah.
Yeah, sitting in the back of the church. Like, that doesn't change. Like, we first see him sitting in the very last pew in the corner, not, you know, singing or clapping along with everyone else, and then when it comes back in at the end of the movie, it's the exact same place, so he's already been separated there. I wonder what they were saying about, and maybe I'm just trying to read too much into this, he's, like, obviously a major collector of African art. Like,
yeah.
His house is covered with the stuff, and the whole catalyst is this ancient weapon that they find.
Asante weapon.
It's not something he's, like, talks about. It's not really something, like, occasionally it comes up, especially in relation to, you know, the Blood Clan or whatever he was thinking of.
Yeah.
But it's not, like, it almost seems like he's got a very remote interest. Like he wants the knowledge, but he's going to keep it to himself. He doesn't want to have a discussion about it. And I don't know. Like it doesn't feel like it's a part of him, even though it is literally everywhere in his house.
I saw it as him trying to connect to like his blackness, because like he's in a very like white dominated field and white dominated area. And, like, that's his way of trying to be like, no, I am still a black man. I have all this African art. It's my connection. Although, like, it's so excessive to the point that it's kind of cartoonish just how much African art is just everywhere in his house.
Yeah, and he's already disconnected from that, too, because that goes along with him going to the church. Because that is, he's traveling into New York from Martha's Vineyard into Red Hook, I assume, just to go to this church. And it's like that.
Yeah, because his driver is a preacher there.
Right. does he even care? Is he doing this just so that he can try to feel like a connection with other people, especially people of his race and culture that he thinks he's supposed to be a part of? This may be just me reaching, but it's interesting to think about.
Yeah, it is.
I think you're onto it. Like, it's about like cultural assimilation, and I mean, it's a classic Spike Lee theme of identity, which shows up in like basically all of his movies the main character or characters trying to realize who they really are and trying to get comfortable with who they are. And in the beginning, where you first see him in the back of the church, I see that as he's just there because his driver is at work. And he's trying to kill time to get somewhere. And later on, I think he's there because he genuinely wants to be there. Because, the way the driver reacts is he definitely is happier. And he's like, oh, you're finally participating. You're finally, joining us. Oh, and I'm trying to not do too many of the differences between these two, because we're doing the Glendron Hess one pretty soon after this, but
sure.
But there's in Glendron Hess, he is divorced and has a child, and this, he's just a single man of late 30s, early 40s, which I think that also, I feel like if he was divorced and had a kid, you wouldn't necessarily believe it, because he's kind of this. Like, what's Dwayne Jones in original, it's like him being divorced and having a kid. It's like, yeah, I would believe Dwayne Jones because he's very traditionally masculine. And with him, it's like, no, it makes sense. Like, he'd be alone, and,
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, he even makes a comment about people assume if it's a man his age and unmarried that, he must be gay, which is just kind of washed over thing. But maybe that's another problem with Spike Lee. Does he have any movies with characters that are male homosexuals?
Yeah, I mean, Get on the Bus, Isaiah Washington, and I forgot the actor's name, the guy from Five Heartbeats. They're both gay, they're exes.
Okay. Wait, Isaiah Washington
and
from Grey's Anatomy fame.
What?
Isaiah Washington from Grey's Anatomy?
Yeah, Isaiah Washington was a Spike Lee regular. He's in a few of his movies. Clockers, Crooklyn, Get on the Bus.
Oh,
there was that period where they used to work together a lot.
Oh, he got kicked off of Grey's Anatomy for using a homophobic slur.
He did. Go figure. And in Summer of Sam, there's that whole subplot where Adrian Brody dances at a gay male review type place. So it comes up occasionally in his movies.
Yeah.
In real life,
yeah.
I don't know too much about him politically besides he's on the left. Is he pro LGBTQ stuff in general?
I'm not sure. It's a good question. I don't want this to veer off too much. I know he's not the biggest fan of, when there's this sometimes co-opting of, their struggle. It's just the black struggle. It's just like the civil rights struggle. And it's kind of no, it's not. Not to diminish what you're I know Spike Lee has sometimes in the past been vocal about that. Don't try to co-opt, my culture struggle or black struggle. I know he's made some comments like that over the years, but at the end of the day, I think he's, I don't know if he's pro or not. He's never said he's anti. I don't know. I mean, I guess this that you almost have to take a side, or you'll get judged or something. I don't know.
Nowadays.
But, He hasn't done anything that would lead me to believe he's anti.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but on the, you talked about appropriation, Is he with the party scene when the white woman is like, "Oh, what are you drinking? Is it, what's that red wine? Like, is that supposed to be like a take on like white culture trying to take from black culture?" And then she like adds to like his drink.
Say that again. What do you mean?
In the dinner.
I know the scene you're talking about, but
the moment white woman like sees him drinking the blood out of the wine glass and like and wants to like drink it herself and like add like pepper and like bitters to it or whatever. That's supposed to be him like commenting on like white appropriation of black culture.
I mean, if he...
That's interesting. Yeah, well, I didn't... I mean, it could be, or it could be the other way around. Just the whole idea of, like, wine is I'm not saying I agree with this, but I'm just saying, you know, oh, drinking wine, that's traditionally, like, not a black thing. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. when you think of wine at Martha's Vineyard, you think of, like, white people doing that, not black people. So it could be, you know, him trying to assimilate to them. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And then there's also, like, you know, a double meaning. Like, Spike Lee has a home in Martha's Vineyard, and I'm sure he's been in that position. There's not a lot of black people in Martha's Vineyard. I mean, I'm from New England, and you don't even need to be from New England to know that. So it's like there could be some, like, semi-autobiographical, you know, stuff, you know, from Spike Lee's own personal experiences bleeding into that scene, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'm not sure, but that's a good observation, I think.
Yeah, I'm there are other like nods to like assimilation and appropriation throughout it, but I've only been in New York maybe 5 times in my whole life, and is Martha's Vineyard?
No, Martha's Vineyard is not part of New York City.
Okay. Like
No.
I mean, I'm coming off of stupid, but I've never been to New York for very long, so like I'm not sure, like, is Martha's Vineyard like very far out from the city? Like, is it
no, I mean, it's not, no, Martha's Vineyard's New England. It's like, huh. It's that's Massachusetts.
Oh
yeah, it's an island in Massachusetts. Yeah,
yeah, he was taking there was that scene where he was like taking a private flight, so that's what he's been doing.
Oh, are you thinking of like the Hamptons maybe? Are you confusing that with,
I don't know, I
because the Hamptons, which is another place mm-hmm. where like the rich people go, that's on Long Island, New York, which is outside of, I mean, Long Island is outside of New York City, but you might be confusing that. No, yeah,
because like the movie's set in Martha's Vineyard in New York City, so like I'm trying to figure out like the geography and.
No, I mean it's a few hours away.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But like
not far, because Massachusetts is only so big, but.
Oh.
It's, I mean, and even within Mass, it's not like mainland Massachusetts. It's like I said, you know, it's an island.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, like the geography in that region is all kind of like, there's New York City and there's Boston and there's Western Mass, and that's kind of all I know.
Connecticut and all that. Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, yeah.
But, the Hamptons, my grandfather is from the Hamptons, so that when he grew up there in the 40s, it was his middle class black neighborhood. And by the time he left, it was starting to change.
Right.
Yeah. And that was like in the 60s. So like, it wasn't always like a rich neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, you got, Diddy's out there now. He's reclaiming it, I guess.
Well,
no, I'm just kidding.
sorry. Yeah, I was laughing.
Yeah, the because like another thing that stuck out is like skin color, because Stephen Tyrone Williams is very dark, of Tangier, the ex. She's very light. Actually, my complexion. Minus the, I don't have blue eyes like she does, because that's kind of freaky. And Ganja is kind of like in the middle. So is he trying to like comment on like colorism and feeling, not colorism?
I'm sure when it comes with Spike Lee, women and color, I think that's always a thing. I mean, look at Mo Better Blues. I mean, like at the end of the day, you know, you have Bleak, choosing, you know, the darker skinned woman over the light skinned woman. And then, you know, it's I mean, take out the interracial aspect of Jungle Fever. Just like Spike Lee's black wife, I mean, she's very light skinned, and they even have that conversation when he's just like, color's got you all fucked up. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I always thought, you know, I don't hear a lot of people say this, but I always thought the end of Jungle Fever, mm-hmm. he was trying to send a message, you know, when Wesley Snipes grabs Halle Berry mm-hmm. and he goes, no, I think that was his, like, weird kind of preachy finger-waving way of, like, hey, black women, you know, do better, don't do crack, take care of yourself, because, you know, these black guys are, you know, going to go and try to find, you know, white women or something like that, which is not out of Spike Lee's wheelhouse to try to preach that.
Yeah.
Ironically, of course, I'm engaged to a white woman, but whatever.
Ooh.
Well, if you have kids, they're going to look like me.
All right. No, I'm kidding.
I don't know if that's a good thing. But
it doesn't matter. I don't care. I just want kids. I don't care what they look like.
Yeah, I like.
I know some kids you can have.
But, like the skin tone really comes into play with the sex scene between Ganja and Hess, where, you see just how much darker he is compared to her. And it's just, like,
yeah.
And with there, it's like, is this trying to, like, my first thought was, this is clearly commenting on, like, skin tone and colorism and all that stuff. But,
yeah.
And, like, you know, the very, very light-skinned ex and the lesbian scene between the two lighter-skinned women, which, like, you know, the whole thing of, like, lighter-skinned women are seen as more, what's the word I'm trying to think of? More attractive by society.
Sure, sure. I know what you're trying to, yeah.
And, like, you know, it just feels like...
It could be a mix of that. It could be a mix of, like, just... You know, with the color, the background colors and the type of camera you use, it could have just looked good. Two different skin tones, mm-hmm. you know, on top of each other. It could have been a few things.
Yeah. I don't know. There's still a lot of stuff I'm trying to piece together.
Sure.
And like,
I think that's a positive thing about there. There are a lot of things you can tear into in the movie. Like.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was saying earlier. Like, this is something that you can kind of talk about. Even if you don't completely love it, or, you know, like, or if you don't completely hate it, like, there's just stuff you could just kind of talk about, you know.
Yeah, and, like, there's some lines from I watched half of it again last night, because I was like, uh-huh. I kind of need to see some of the skin, because I love how the music is incorporated.
Because
the soundtrack is fucking incredible. Like,
The soundtrack is really good. There's, you know, what sucks is for a second, you know, like in the whole music blogosphere, one of the groups from that soundtrack mm-hmm. was like kind of set to blow up, and nothing ever happened to this group, Govalis. Mm-hmm. They did that song Doors to Nowhere, which is a really good song, I think. They were getting a lot of like play on OK Player mm-hmm. and like Tiny Mixtapes and like a lot of music blogs, and they just kind of like disappeared. Oh. They did release a project, but like... Because that's the song that's used in the trailer. By the way, I have to say, the trailer to this movie is cut really good. I remember when I saw the trailer, I was like, oh, this is so good. But yeah, I enjoyed the soundtrack too.
Yeah, and like some of the music cues were very on the nose. Like when he's having a crisis of faith, the song is I Don't Feel God. And it's playing a chorus. And
mm-hmm. One of them was when he changed... Ganja, it was like too long or something like that.
The song is called Too Far, I think. And
I've gone too long or too far or too long or something.
And at the garden party, when he goes to his house from like he leads like the big bright party full of all the rich white people, and then he goes into like the basement and it's hip hop playing immediately. And it's like dark and brown, and like during the hooker scene, it's playing this song called Coochie Time.
Yeah, me and Sarah were laughing at those lyrics because I had the subtitles on, and it's just like looking at my coochie, and it's about that time.
And let's see, there was a couple lines that stuck out second time through, which was practice safe sex, which I feel like it has to have like a deeper meaning because like it the way it's because it's played over after the scene is cut, and it's. She's like the nurse is talking, and like he's going back home.
Well, yeah, she says practice safe sex. He says, "I will." And then, like after the scene is cut, you hear her voice going, "Like, yeah, right."
And that I'm trying to figure out like this, like, what that is trying to tie into. And there was like the whole.
That's a pretty on the nose. Like he wanted to include something about the. The whole AIDS thing.
Yeah. But I feel like it...
And how people are, like, they're not careful about it. Like, this... Like, he literally goes to a club and you know, he picks up a woman and he doesn't sleep with her, but, you know, the equivalent of it. Like, he's drinking her blood and, like, he's got the advantage that his body was like, I'm rejecting this right away, and he freaks out when he opens up her purse. By the way, is she walking around the city?
Was she what?
Is she walking around the city somewhere? Because he sits around and waits for her to wake up again.
Yeah, she is still alive, I guess.
Yeah.
And there's the line.
That actress was in the Wire, and I was like, what the hell? What's going on here?
Because she was?
Yes.
Who was she?
Have you seen The Wire?
I watched season 1-4, but I don't recognize her in this.
She is... How do I describe her? I mean, she's one of
is she Kima's?
She's
not Kima's wife.
She's not one of the cops. She's one of the not D'Angelo, not Barksdale. The other Marlowe. He's got two people that are like going around leaving dead bodies and nailing the boards over the doors.
This before
and she's one of the. I can't remember what her name is, but she's very, there's no other way to say it. She's very masculine in the show.
Oh, I remember her now.
Yeah.
Yeah, Snoop, or Lil Snoop, whatever her name is.
Snoop, there you go.
Yeah, Snoop, yeah.
So I was like, what the hell?
Okay, yeah. I did not recognize her at all in this.
Oh, her voice is so distinctive.
Yeah.
It's been too long since I've seen Wire.
Nah.
Yeah, but there's other line about a system I don't know what I'm talking about, but they talk about like a big working within a system, and like I guess like trying to figure out your place in the system, which ties into a whole loneliness, and I know there's this whole lot of stuff I'm still. Trying to piece together, but overall, I really did enjoy this movie. I found myself watching it again and just enjoying it even more. Just like watching just how beautiful it looks, and like the way the music is used, and the comedy still doesn't work, but I might buy this on Blu-ray. If there's a blurry of it, because I kind of want to see like all the, like the garden party and all the other like outside scenes, in that like beautiful.
Yeah, I looked it up. There is a Blu-ray, but it's out of print, so it's like at least $55.
No,
unfortunately, but I might be willing to shell out that money. I like this movie a lot.
Yeah, and it also ties into African history with like the Asante, with like the talking about how like the Asante were like violent, which. Well, it's true. They are basically like the Roman Empire of West Africa. And like it was like, you join us or we kill you. And the whole thing, like their addiction to blood and like their punishments. I have about 50 books on African history. And I want to read about maybe 5 of them because they're like textbooks more or less. But like some of their punishments for like if a woman was caught cheating, they had to cut off her nose. And so, like, the whole violence and brutality of the Santi is, it's not, like, made up. Like, it really was a yes, yeah, it's kind of like an eye for an eye type society, like this kind of taken to a bit of an extreme,
right?
And so also it's like Asante art in general. I have one artifact that's a fertility statue that I might post a picture on Twitter if I remember. So
don't get any of your blood on it.
Oh, I will not. I got to keep away from Freya because Mia would, so she might chew on it. Marcus, I guess you would recommend this movie too?
I absolutely would, yeah.
All right, so do you have other 2014 movies you'd recommend?
I absolutely do. Well, how many? I'll just lead in with my favorite movie of 2014 was it's a little weird. It's a film. It was whittled down from a TV series and had a film version. It's called Lil' Kin Kin. It was Bruno Dumont's film / miniseries. It's really, really good. It's definitely in that kind of like Twin Peaks. I don't want to say knockoff because that has a negative connotation, but it's definitely in that realm of like it you know, weird, quirky, surreal, small town, gruesome murder.
Mm-hmm.
And like these quirky detectives from the outside come into the small town. Nobody wants to cooperate. Damn, this really sounds a lot like Twin Peaks, actually. but yeah, Lil Kin Kin was my favorite movie of 2014. No question. And it's one of those films too where I feel like I would recommend it to just about anyone. And not everyone would like it, but it's one of those things where, like, even if you don't like it, you're not going to be upset. Like, you're not going to feel like your time was wasted.
Because
it's really weird. I wouldn't even mind this being someone's intro to Bruno Dumont's work, even though, you know, he'd been working, you know, long before that. But, yeah.
All right. I guess I'm next.
Jodorowsky's Dune is cool. Mm-hmm. That was another 2014 movie where, you know...
Oh, the documentary.
The movie itself is really, really good. And it also... This is another thing, too. I wish someone would dedicate, like, a podcast episode to that movie. Because the thing... What I always found interesting about the hype around that movie is, oh, my God, Jodorowsky was going to make Dune. How did this not get made? And it's just one of those things where, like, everyone's so certain that Jodorowsky's version of Dune was going to be good. We're like, not necessarily. I mean, on paper, it sounds just as... I mean, David Lynch's Dune sounds just as bonkers when you read it on paper, but executing it is another thing. But the movie itself, it is really good.
Yeah.
And also, that was... what was it? Eliza Skinner's debut, It Felt Like Love, came out that year. That was another one of my top movies of 2014 as well.
I just remembered one I forgot about, The Raid 2.
Yes.
I love The Raid 2.
Oh,
I don't care.
Damn.
I don't care if 2.5 hours. The action is so good. Oh. I think it's worth it.
Yeah.
Is it? That movie's 2.5 hours?
It is. Yeah.
I saw that in the theater.
Yeah. Me too.
Yeah. It played in one theater in the state where I live. It's me and another black guy, and and we are like a high five and clapping, nice. Just having a great time.
Are you serious? You're high fiving?
Yeah, once.
Because another movie that came out this year, which I honestly don't actually like, but I had a lot of fun seeing it in the theater with my friend. 300: Rise of Empire.
Oh, I saw that. That's a stupid ass movie.
Yeah. The part in the beginning where, like, you know, it's like a war scene, of course, going on, and then there's a part where a horse rears up and it lands on somebody's head, and it was in 3D, and we just looked at each other and we were like high-fiving, like, what the hell?
I would recommend the other 300 movie, but just know it's stupid and bad.
Oh yeah,
but it definitely is fun. But like Raid 2 is literally a fucking action movie.
That's great. That's like one of the best action movies in my opinion.
Yeah. And,
the one thing that bugs me about Raid 2, it's like plot-wise, it's kind of like, hey, you have to go undercover and go to jail for like 2 years and befriend this guy which I think is a bit much, but besides mm-hmm. that one plot point, I do like the rest of that movie.
Yeah, it feels kind of like a Battles with Honor and Humanity movie, like one of those like crazy mid-70s Yakuza movies that like right. covers like a huge stretch of time, but yeah. still a still movie, although it's not nearly as convoluted as the battle movies are by that series also, but it's a Raid 2, Grand Budapest Hotel, because that's I think the only Wes Anderson movie I've ever seen in a theater.
Oh,
but I think like the only ones may have played near me, because it may be Life Aquatic, but I would have been too young when that came out in theater.
You can see Moonlight but Kingdom.
I don't think that played in my state. Mm. I remember checking, and I think closest was Baltimore.
Outlawed in Delaware.
Yeah, we don't get much. But Grand Budapest, if you like Wes Anderson, great. If you don't like Wes Anderson, don't tell me, because I don't care if you don't like Wes Anderson. But, yeah, I went to see it the next week, and it was already gone. It played for like a week at the multiplex. And I have no one, but Joel, you covered it on your show, so you get to take it.
Oh, sure. I mean, you can chime in with anything. Like, 2014 apparently is a big year for Please Don't Send Me Into Outer Space, the science fiction and fantasy movie podcast I do. We did, one of our earliest movies was a really crappy movie called Parts Per Billion that is about the...
Oh, Rosario Dawson's in that, right?
Yeah. Josh Hartnett and Rosario Dawson and Frank Langella, you know, freaking wow. Jenna Rollins, for God's sake. But it's like,
whoa, what the hell?
Yeah, it's bad. It's not a good movie. A virus breaks out and most of society's dying, and you just see these people, you know, their relationships are either falling apart or getting closer or whatever, and it didn't work. Predestination came out that year. That is a crazy ass movie with Ethan Hawke in it. That it's a time travel-y twisty thing that I don't want to talk about it because I don't want to give away what happens in it. People should just watch it. It was probably like a directed DVD type thing, but like
I blew your guest Jose. Spoils pretty quickly in episode. You have to censor him.
Yeah, after I say the we're gonna do the spoilers, the first thing he does is spoil it. No, I bleep him out because he cusses, not because he's spoiling. but that's Predestination's a really good movie. Killer Mermaid, aka Nymph, another piece of shit. but at least this one's a fun piece of shit. It's just like a low budget kind of monster movie that I don't know if I would recommend watching it, but maybe if you're like a group of friends, it'd be fun to make fun of. Same thing with Firequake. I'm sorry, were you gonna say something?
No, I was just saying.
Oh, okay. Firequake, another low budget thing. It seems like these might be from the same country, which is not the US. Mm-hmm. And that one we had a ton of fun with, making fun of just as it was going on. It's not good, but it's at least listen to the episode. We have a lot of fun talking about how stupid it is. Ex Machina. Okay. That's
I forgot that was that year too.
Yeah, that's one of my probably in my top 25 movies of all time at this point. Like
that has one of my favorite movie scenes in recent years.
Oh yeah.
Which is, I think we all know.
Yeah.
The scene, which is so good.
The what scene?
When Oscar Isaac is dancing out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's so unexpected when it happens. Like, even just knowing that's going to happen, if you haven't seen the movie, don't look up that scene. Watch the movie, and you'll be shocked when that part happens.
Yeah.
I, Frankenstein, Edge of Tomorrow, those are the other ones. Edge of Tomorrow is the one you wanted to talk about, though.
Yeah, so that's a
lay into
it. I I really enjoyed it at the time. Like, halfway through the movie, I thought they were going to do a twist of, actually, Emily Blunt will be the hero the whole time, and like he and Tom Cruise will pick, be on the sidelines, and it didn't do that. But Emily Blunt is fucking awesome it, and she's kicks some ass, and Tom Cruise goes. It's like, I think it's the first Tom Cruise movie I ever saw in the theater, but like that's the first movie I was like, oh, this guy is a movie star. Like, I'd seen some stuff like Magnolia at that point, but like this was the first time, like, okay, you know, like I get why this guy has a status he has. And like, I didn't know what to expect, because I think I saw the trailers, because like if it on TV, I just turn change channel because it looked dumb. And I was really, if you proved me wrong, I thought it'd be something stupid and bad, and it's a really good action movie that I don't know if it ever made some money back in America, but I think it didn't do well here.
Yeah, that's a shame, because it is really good. Yeah. And it's got Bill Paxton in it. That you have to watch it.
Yeah. Yeah. Is it called Kill Diary Pete now or something?
I mean, that's what they decided to focus on the advertising is, but as far as I know, it's still called Edge of Tomorrow everywhere, but you might see Live, Die, Repeat in big letters on a DVD or whatever.
And there's one more that it's a movie that I have issues with, but I find interesting, Tusk, the Kevin Smith movie. It's like,
yeah, like Kevin Smith movie, yeah.
It's him trying to make like a weird 70s horror movie like The Baby, but it's like he doesn't get how to make like a weird 70s horror movie. Mm. I don't know, like I like some of it, then it has the Kevin Smithisms that kind of really irritate me. So like, I don't know, I'm kind of all over the place on it. I think
it's notable.
I think it's more, yes, I don't think it's as bad as people say. It's definitely an interesting, strange movie that kind of doesn't work and is like maybe 10 minutes too long. But besides that, it's, I don't know, it's a real curiosity.
Would you say it's long in the tooth? Okay. There were a bunch of great things that came out in 2014. I'm just gonna rattle through, like the Interstellar came out, Winter Soldier, which is probably my favorite of the whole Marvel things. Nightcrawler. John Wick.
Yep, Nightcrawler.
Yeah.
John Wick. Mm-hmm. The Unknown Known. Errol Morris's Donald Rumsfeld documentary, which nobody tried to cancel that movie, but I guess canceling didn't exist in 2014.
I'm still waiting for America Dharma. I just want to see that movie.
It's really good.
It Follows, What We Do in the Shadows, The Babadook. Mm. My personal favorite P.T. Anderson movie, Inherent Vice, which I don't care if you think that I'm crazy, I love it. Foxcatcher, I could go on.
Foxcatcher has a dark connection. It's about the DuPonts. Yeah. Or person is a DuPont.
It's got a what connection?
Delaware. Oh. The DuPont family.
Oh, the murderers are from your state. That's nice.
Yeah, the one I is part of the DuPonts, and I think it's might be set in Delaware.
Yeah,
I skipped it because I kind of knew the story already and didn't care.
I think the world skipped it. I just brought it up because I like it a lot. I'm not sure if many people agree.
I mean, I'm sure it's better than I thought. It's at the time, it's like, yeah, everyone here kind of knows the story to an extent. Mm. So I kind of was all over it.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's it. Marcus, thank you for coming on.
Of course, anytime.
Yeah, well, when we're done, I'll ask you about another episode at the end of the year. But, before we get to that, don't you have a website and a podcast and all that stuff?
I do, yes. Go to PinlandEmpire.com. I've been writing more recently, so go there. Go to... listen to Zebras in America, Coming up, I'll be making some more podcast appearances. You'll be hearing me on Wrong Reel in the near future. I'm sitting on a bunch of stuff for Pinland Empire. So, yeah, Pinland Empire, Zebras in America. Check them out.
All right. Joel, your Spacecast thing?
Yeah, go to pdsmios.com for any details on there. That's just basically takes you to the Podbean site. But there's a episodes tab that you can click on, which has all the list of all the movies we've covered. We've covered more than just movies from 2014. But upcoming stuff, we recorded a movie on a movie called Star Crystal, which is terrible. What we do after that? Pretty soon we're going to release an episode on Duncan Jones' movie Mute from 2018.
Oh, you like that one?
I did, and I expected to hate it because apparently everyone else did. But maybe
that's
I'm just
creepy.
A sucker.
That's creepy Paul Rudd, right?
Yes, it. It's got a villainous Paul Rudd, but he's if we had to talk about creepy characters, he's not the creep mm-hmm. In that movie. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. For me, Jailhouse. What was it called? Jailhouse 701, Japanese cult cinema. I'm finally closing out. Hashtag Chiba Checkup Volume 2 with Wolf Guy, a werewolf movie that Sonny Chiba did. It's a really fascinating, interesting movie. And by the time this comes out, the review should be up. And what else? I think that's kind of my thing. Just you can also look at last year's hashtag Chiba Chick. If you love Shiny Chiba, I'd recommend all the movies I covered. If you don't like Shiny Chiba, go read the reviews to see which ones are the good ones, which ones to skip. But Wolf Guy is definitely one that needs to be experienced. It's really something special. But it's on Shudder for stream. I think it's the only place you can stream it right now. So we'll be at the end of the month, and we'll have an episode on Losing Ground, maybe with Entombe again. I'm not sure, but I think it might be Entombe. We'll be on that one. So.
All right.
Yeah. And that's it. See you next time.
Thanks for being on, Marcus.
All right.
Of course, thank you.
The show's email is highandlowpod@gmail.com. It made no sense to change email, so it's the same feed. The show can be found at podbean.com, and Spotify, and other places you can find podcasts. Please rate and review whenever possible. The logo is by Josh Hollis. The music is by James Fell, and thank you for listening.